Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is Andrew Davis, author of Town Inc., Grow Your Business, Save Your Town, Leave Your Legacy. And you are listening to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails.
Hello and welcome to this hopefully short-lived series that will be airing in addition to the weekly Marketing Book podcast interviews. I'm your host, Douglas Burdett, and my goal during this unusual time is to reconnect you with past guests on the Marketing Book podcast, share some ideas and inspiration, and maybe a much-needed laugh or two. I've interviewed over 200 authors on the show, and my plan is to continue this series until I either run out of authors or quarantine, whichever comes first. A word of warning, the host and guest may very likely be drinking cocktails during these conversations. I mean, come on. They are recorded during the cocktail hour. To find the show notes for each episode with pictures of each guest and links mentioned in their conversation, visit marketingbookcocktails.com. marketingbookcocktails.com. See what I did there? And if you'd like to join the conversation, email a voice recording to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, and I'll try to include it in a future episode. I'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat. Andrew Davis, welcome to Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you so much for having me. This is great. I've got my cocktail open and ready now.
Well, you know what?
Oh, there we
so
go.
So do I.
That sounds good. What
cheers,
are you drinking tonight,
cheers,
Douglas?
My friend.
I'm drinking
some of this stuff. My college-aged daughter, who was a senior in college, and she came home for spring break, and then they said, yeah, don't come back, and we can't do graduation either. So suddenly the fridge is full of all these hard seltzer drinks.
Oh.
And I'm loving them.
That's great.
You know, I'm into what the kids are doing these days, you know?
Yeah, you're way cooler than me, I got to be honest.
Well, now, wait a minute.
I have not tried one yet.
You have a beer from Florida there, right?
Yeah, I'm drinking. This is called High Lie, you know, named after the game. Have you ever heard of High Lie, the game?
Oh, yes. I think you can't name a beer High Lie unless it is brewed in Florida.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
like it would be like Greyhound beer.
That's right. Exactly. So High Lie's a beer from Tampa that I really love from a really little craft brewery called Cigar City.
I know that Tampa brewery. Yeah.
It's great. And so this is one of my favorite beers. And in quarantine, I've actually been trying to lose weight. So I haven't been drinking many High Lies because as soon as I started counting calories, I realized this is a poor use of calories. So I've been, this is like a real treat for me, Douglas.
As it is for myself and the listeners. So, you know, I'm glad that, you know, it's okay to have that beer because you're with the listeners to the
podcast. This is for you, not for me.
That's right. Andrew Davis, he suffers for his art.
Exactly. So do you. This is tough, man. Drinking every night, having great conversation with smart people. I've been listening. This is fun.
Wow. Thank you. Well, I'm going to have to take this a little more seriously. If I know Andrew Davis is listening,
no,
I have to up my game here. So, no. Andrew Davis, you were episode 56, and we're up to about episode 280 now.
Wow.
And I published that interview in February of 2016.
Wow.
So, I was going to ask you, remind listeners who may not have heard that episode, in your own words, who you are, what you do, and what you've authored.
Yeah, sure. So who am I? Wow. This is what quarantine has really forced me to think through.
I'll be back in about 30 minutes to see how you're doing.
No, I think I'm getting there. I'm a marketing guy by trade, but I started my career in the television business. So I come out of television really. And then I started a marketing agency. And these days, I just write books like Town Inc. and Brandscaping. And I'm working on a new one called The Loyalty Loop. And most of the time, I travel around the world speaking to groups of all kinds. So this is actually the longest I've been home since, I think, since 2012 or 2013.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah. And you've got a third book coming up. I just file this away. I know this guy, and he interviews authors of new marketing and sales.
You're on my list. I keep a very, very attuned list of all the smartest people creating great content in the book space. And you're at the top of the list. I subscribe. I get the emails.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then when Carla Johnson emailed me last week and said she'd been on the show, I was like, wow, this is great. Look, you're a powerhouse. You've been putting out great content for a long time. So,
well, thank you.
I have a super secret book in the works too, which we can't talk about right now, but it's top secret. And if people it's just for speakers, really. So that's why it's top secret.
You know, I've gotten a book for speakers lately. I've been meaning to get him back on the show, but everything kind of got discombobulated. A guy named David Newman, you probably know.
Oh yeah, I know David Newman. Yeah, that's great. His book is good. Yeah, it's a great book. There's so many great speaking books. Yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed him about his marketing book, and then he said, "Hey, I got this one out." And I said, "Great." And I gotta get back on here.
The super secret project is going to be fun. And I know you do a lot of speaking too.
Well, not as much as Andrew Davis, but I don't do it for a living. I do it to pretty much for the open bar.
For the agency.
Yeah. I just gave my price away there. So I guess I'm a cheap date, but again, I suffer for my art. So wait a minute. Now you Andrew Davis, he's one of those most interesting men in marketing. You got to go back. You said you worked in television, but hold on.
Yeah.
You were a child actor.
Yes. Oh, wow. You're going really far back. Yeah. I was a child actor. I did like television commercials and lots of theater and like for Cadbury's Chocolates and Chevrolet and McDonald's and Astroworld. I lived in Houston, Texas at the time. So I did. Astroworld was like a really great amusement park. And as a kid doing television commercials for Astroworld, every other kid thought it was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
So I think at the end of the day, like my love and interest in marketing and business collided with my passion for performing. And that's how I ended up being a speaker and a writer, I think.
Well, you seem to be having the most fun of anybody because I watch your videos, and I'm going to include a link to your blog, your website.
Oh, thanks.
And those videos you do are just mesmerizing. And we're going to get into that because your keynotes are too. But, I recently interviewed a friend of yours, Ian Altman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He was a child actor.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he was a better child actor than me. And he's got a great smile still. He's got like those kid looks.
right. And I'm just I hear all these stories about these poor souls who were child actors and then they just had these really awful lives. And I say, wait a minute, Andrew and Ian, they either have adjusted well or they are really good actors at keeping all that trauma bottled up.
No. Here's how it works, Douglas. If you're a really successful child actor, you're basically, it's just downhill after that. It's drugs and, you never can hold a relationship. If you're a mediocre actor that barely made it, you recover pretty well.
Oh,
that's how it works.
Wow. We all develop our coping mechanisms, but wait a minute, let's not leave your childhood. Okay. Cause I recall when you were in high school, it was in Houston, Texas, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You wore a coat and tie to school every day. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yes, I did. I wore a tie every day. They called me the tie guy. It was a very big high school. So,
well, it's all about standing out, finding your niche.
That's right. And I still wear my bow tie every time I speak and doing these virtual events. I'm dressed in my bow tie in my office, doing webinars with my bow tie on. I love it. You're a bow tie guy too.
I'm a bow tie guy. And Scott Monty's a bow tie guy. Mm-hmm. And it's the brotherhood of the bow ties.
The bow tie brotherhood. I know. Yeah. That's a very exclusive group. Did you know that the Time magazine, when it was still a magazine, did a survey of I don't know, it was a huge survey, like 20,000 Americans, and asked them if you trust a person with a bow tie. And it split exactly down the middle. 50% trust you less if you're wearing a bow tie, and 50% trust you more if you're wearing a bow tie. How crazy is that?
Wow. Well, now what happens after they get to know me? So I guess the numbers go even worse.
That's your own survey you need to launch.
Right. Wow. And then the other thing that's so interesting, I look up the word perseverance in the dictionary, and at least in my mental dictionary, there's a picture of Andrew Davis. And it's right next to a picture of the Muppets. Tell us the story of the Muppets.
Yeah. So what my dream job was to work with the Jim Henson Company with the Muppets. And from when I was a little kid, I mean, I made my own marionette theater out of a refrigerator box. And then my first business was actually selling birthday parties on my marionette entertainment show for $50, which was a lot of money in the late 70s, early 80s.
That was probably more than you got as a child actor.
Yeah, it probably was actually. But it was, I think it was really, you know, it was a lot of work to like cart this refrigerator box that I had covered in like, I don't know, spandex, which was new at the time, out to these birthday parties. So $50 seemed like a good amount. I wanted to work at the Jim Henson Company for a long time. And I was living in Boston at the time and was like, you know, how am I going to get a job at the Jim Henson Company? They're never going to, you know, hear from me. And they're never posting jobs. So I started writing a letter every single month to an executive at the Jim Henson Company. And it, you know, I kind of rolled through different kinds of executives. And then Peter Van Roden was the head of production there. So I started writing him a letter every month. And the letters were like, hey, congratulations on your award, you know, another Emmy for Sesame Street's amazing. Or it was like, hey, congratulations on your deal with Sony. What a big picture deal. Or, hey, I have three ideas that might help the Jim Henson Company. Here's what I'm thinking. And eventually, after about 3 years of this, Peter Van Roden called me. And I was like, yes, finally, I'm going to get an interview. And he called and said, hey, look, I appreciate these letters, but you're just wasting your time. Because I was FedExing them. And as a guy, just straight out of college without, you know, much money in the bank, FedEx was expensive for me. It was like $35 every time I was sending this thing. Wow. And so he said, look, you know, just I appreciate it, but we don't need the letters. We don't have any openings. We'll call you. And I said, look, I'll stop sending the letters, Peter, if you just give me a half hour of your time in your office. He said, sure, no problem. We set it up on the calendar. I took the bus down to New York. I stopped at a hotel and went into the bathroom and changed into my suit. I went and sat down with Peter Van Roden.
You didn't have a hotel room. You just used the hotel restroom.
Oh, yeah, just the hotel restroom, like right down the street from the Jim Henson Company.
I'm trying to act like I don't know that trick.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, we've all done it. Then I walked into the office. We had an hour and a half meeting instead of a half hour meeting. At the end of it, he said, look, if you can start, he invited me to start on September 8th, which is just after Memorial Day, or what is it? Labor Day? What's the September holiday?
Labor Day.
I always get that one. Labor Day. He said, if you can start the Monday after Labor Day, you've got yourself a job. And I was like, all right, I'm in. So I packed up my stuff from Boston, moved down, and worked at the Jim Henson Company for a few years. The best part of that story, by the way, is that I met my wife at the Jim Henson Company.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Elizabeth was in charge of all the puppeteers. They call them Muppeteers because they're Muppets. And I was in charge of the Muppets themselves. So anytime a Muppeteer needed a Muppet, you know, to be on the Sesame Street set or down in Wilmington, North Carolina to shoot a movie, we had to coordinate our, you know, together. And she needed a Muppet Wrangler one night to go. That's what they called it, Muppet Wrangling.
Sure.
That's the person in charge of the Muppet. She needed someone to go down to see Tony Bennett and bring Elmo. And no one was in the office except for me. So I said, I would do it. And she was like, well, do you know how to Muppet Wrangle? I'd been there like 2 weeks. I was like, no, but I'll figure it out. And I went down, met Tony Bennett. I met the Backstreet Boys because it was a VH1 Behind the Music episode. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience. And then I came back and I asked her out on a date, and that was the beginning of our relationship. And now we've been married 18 years.
Wow. And she's still pretty much in charge.
oh my Lord, are you kidding? She's really in charge. She runs, I got to whisper because she's just down the hall. We're in quarantine, you know, I'm not in my office.
Well,
and if she hears this.
Yeah, I appreciate her setting this up. But the truth is, Andrew, she's been texting me all day saying, would you please talk to him for a long time? Because I need some Elizabeth time.
She's, you know what? She just said that last night. I said, hey, isn't this fun? And she was like, you know what? I need like an hour. I just want to watch one of my shows. I just need to decompress. You see, I'm an early riser. When do you get up, Douglas?
Oh, usually at 6.
Yeah. Okay. 6. So I'm an early riser.
You get up before
I get up at like 4. Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know why. I'm a morning person. So my wife always says, you have like 3 or 4 hours before I get up. And it's like your own alone time. And now that we're in quarantine, like, you know, if we're up all day, then I've got no time for me, Elizabeth. So she's very grateful that you took up happy hour. She's right now, she's having a blast out there. Just, she turned on the radio.
Excellent.
Turn it down.
You know, whatever I can do to help. And, you know, interesting fact, as I like to say, Tony Bennett and my dad were in the same infantry division in World War II.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow. Tony Bennett, I am a huge fan of Tony Bennett. And I wrote about him in my first book, Brandscaping, because he reinvented his career. I mean, he was a drugged out, you know, kind of ne'er-do-well with no money living in Vegas. And he reinvented his career by partnering with other artists and introduced himself to a new generation. And, you know, it transformed his career. In fact, it wasn't really Tony Bennett's idea. It was his son's idea, Dan Bennett. They came up with this idea of partnering with other artists to get access to their audience. And that's what propelled Tony Bennett back into the spotlight. I would have never known who Tony Bennett was if it wasn't for those duet albums. Do you remember those?
Yeah, those were in the 90s, I think.
Yeah, in the 90s, exactly. Yeah, and he did duets with everybody who was everybody.
Wow, that's amazing. I love listening to him. But you mentioned Brandscaping, and I want to ask you to tell briefly what that book is about. But before we do that, I have to tell another Andrew Davis story. Okay, so 2012, I think, back, you know, when you weren't traveling as much as you have been lately, I saw you speak at a conference in Boston, and it was the Inbound Conference.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm pretty sure it was 2012. And at the time, they had this thing called the partner track. So any agency people that were using HubSpot, you know, they had a separate track, and they were really, really well done, very interesting and helpful. That's pretty much all I would go to during all the breakout sessions. And so I went to this one and to see you, and it was this big room, and there weren't that many people in there. And I thought, man, somebody has screwed up. And not you, but like somebody at HubSpot or whoever organized the conference. And I'm sure that they fired the right people because I don't think the word got out that you were there. So anyway.
No. You know what was weird about that? Just a quick aside. I wasn't actually supposed to speak there that year.
I wonder if that might have had something to do with it.
Yeah, I think it was because Gary, I'm friendly
Gary
with Gary.
Gary
V was the keynote, and
yes.
Gary had some family stuff that he had to deal with. And Gary called me the night before Inbound and said, hey man, you know, I know you live in Boston. I'm supposed to speak at Inbound tomorrow, but you know, can you be a stand-in if I don't make it? Cause there was a chance he wouldn't make it. And I said, sure, I'd do it. And so I showed up in the morning, we did a tech check, and then Gary made it, which was great.
Oh, you were going to stand in for him as the keynote?
As the keynote, as a backup. It was even planned as if I might have to just delay for 30 minutes, you know, and then Gary would show up. So I was like, well, Gary's here. I watched Gary, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to leave. And they were like, no, we need to put, we've had to change the agenda. we can you do a session? And I was like, sure, I'll do the same session. in that breakout room. And so they like changed the agenda, like, and just made it happen. So I think the reason people weren't there was I wasn't actually supposed to be there.
Oh, well, I guess maybe it just underscores what a loser I am. And I didn't know where I was going, but I remember seeing that you were going to be there. Cause I think I'd already heard you interviewed on some podcast and but anyway, I got the word and I attended, and, it's for agency people, and I think it was like one of the last talks before the cocktail hour started. You know, as a former agency guy yourself, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of us had been drinking since around lunchtime.
Yes.
So Our secrets are out now. Anyway, you gave the talk, and I remember sitting up front because there were only not that many of us in there. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Prezi used, which is a really interesting software thing, alternative, much better to PowerPoint. And anyway, it was really, really good. And from my perspective, and this is why you're such a, you know, you're a professional speaker, you didn't know or care how many people were in there. You were talking as if there were 600 people in there and you were on fire. And I just thought, man, this guy's good.
That's so kind of you. When I watch those speeches from 2012, I cringe. Like, I think I've changed a lot. But I mean, look, I always feel like the people in the room, no matter how many there are here to see and learn. You know, they're here for the show. And it doesn't matter. The people that aren't there don't matter at that point. Like, I'm there 100% for the people that showed up. So I'm glad you were there. And the show was just for you. That's the bottom line.
Well, I was really feeling that way because there were so few of us there. I mean, I don't often get made to feel special, Andrew. And so I appreciate that. We'll always have that day in August 2012. But you know what? That's funny that you say that you were keynoting for Kerry. I still remember that keynote he gave, and I'm quoting from it all the time. And it was just amazing. And I didn't know who he was before that.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Well, this was 2012. I mean, that's 100 years ago in marketing time.
And so, in internet world.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I met Gary Vaynerchuk for the first time right after he launched Wine Library TV.
Oh, so that was a few years ago.
Six.
Yeah. Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. It was really crazy.
Oh, man. So,
and I don't talk to him that much anymore, which is sad because he's such a smart guy.
Yeah. Well, he's busy. I get the impression.
He's busy, yeah.
Yeah. And remind listeners, because I didn't interview about brandscaping because that was pre-podcast, Douglas. And remind us what the concept was behind brandscaping.
So brandscaping is all about leveraging partnerships to get access to your audience. So you're leveraging the audience of other brands to increase demand for the products or services you sell. So it's basically partnering with other brands and creating content together. Just like Tony Bennett.
Yes, I was going to say, that's why you talked about it.
That's the perfect example. Exactly. Yeah. Tony Bennett. It took me a decade to realize that Tony Bennett had a genius marketing strategy that was well ahead of his time, you know, before the internet. And now the fact that everybody has their own email newsletter and they have their own social media following, you know, we can add a lot of value to other people's content. And if you can build a long-term partnership with those brands, you know, you have a steady stream of ready new customers going both ways, which is what's really powerful about it. So that I'm really proud of that book. It's there's a lot in that book, maybe too much.
So then the next book is Town Inc., and that's the one I got to interview you about. And remind listeners the thesis of that. And all I'll say is that I have an economic development client, and I gave him a copy of that book. Okay, and once you explain what it's about, I think people understand why. I gave it a copy. He ended up buying a whole bunch of other copies to give to all the elected officials, everybody on his board, all that sort of thing. So,
and I ended up meeting him at an event in North Carolina. Actually.
Oh, yeah. Mary Lombardi.
Yep, that's right.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
He came up and
he loved your book.
Oh, he's such a nice guy. Yeah, so Town Inc. is basically all about how to market a city or a town to you know, essentially build an economy. The idea is very simple. It turns out I spent 3 years driving around the United States trying to figure out how to answer this question.
Well, it's simple. Let me interject. It's simple, yeah. But for some reason, most places don't get it.
Yes, that's true. Most people don't get it because it's, you know, just like all marketing, it takes a bunch of tough choices. So Town Inc., the central premise is all you have to do is fill in some blanks. Like, our city is the blank capital of the blank, like capital of the South, capital of the state, capital of the country, capital of America, capital of the world. So if you can fill in that blank, you can all of a sudden increase the amount of revenue that is driven into your economy by up to $3 billion a year. That's no insignificant amount. And the problem is it takes a really tough choice. You have to choose to be known for something instead of being known for everything. And the problem with most places is they say, we've got something for everyone. Hey, we've got great shopping. If it's tourism, it's like, we've got great shopping. We have great beaches. We have great attractions. Hey, we have history. They post pictures of their sunset. You know, look, the sun sets everywhere. Like that's the whole point. Like, you don't need another sunset picture to market your place. And if you're going to be successful in marketing or in marketing a place, you have to create something that resonates with someone specific. And so it wasn't hard to see that the places that were known for crazy stuff, like the quick quilting capital of the world, was going to be more successful than the town next door that wasn't known for anything, but had a museum, you know? So
yeah, and that
was a really fun book.
There was a video on your blog from not too long ago where you talked about how knowing who your customers aren't is actually more important.
Yes. I think that's such a clever question to ask. And it's not a question I've thought about very often, but when I saw this guy, Stuart Semple, who started an art company, and essentially made sure that the product could, you have to agree. This guy, Stuart Semple, is an artist from England. And he decided that he would make the blackest black paint you could possibly make, right? It would absorb 97 or 98 or 99% of all the light that came and hit it. And so Stuart realized that if he marketed it, to everybody as the blackest black, that'd be great. But what would be more impressive would be to actually market it specifically not for one person. So he picked an artist who had offended him because he had signed an exclusive deal for the blackest black in the world at that time, which was called Vanta Black. And when you buy the black on Stuart Semple's site, you have to agree, a legal agreement, like you have to check the box to say that you will not give this artist access to your black paint. You will not share it with him. You will not let him use it. You don't know him. You're not a friend of his. And then you check out. And Stuart Semple's art company exploded as a result of this. And he's done it again and again. He did it with T-Mobile, the pinkest pink. Now, I couldn't buy it, by the way, because I own a T-Mobile phone, and you're supposed to agree that you do not, you're not a customer of T-Mobile when you buy it. So I couldn't buy it, but that's genius. It really helps you define who your customer is by actually defining who it's not, because everybody who is not that customer gravitates towards it.
Yeah. So Town Inc.
Long explanation. Yeah.
No. The Town Inc. book. So I interviewed you about it, and read it, mm-hmm. loved it, gave it to the client, and some of the things that were in there. He wasn't a big economic development guy, but he wasn't a big proponent of this whale hunting. Like, yeah, let's get Amazon to move here. He's like, no, mm-hmm. no. Yeah. And so a lot of this, I think for him, he was kind of headed in that direction, and it really crystallized for him. Mm-hmm. But what I then did is I said, Andrew, you got to send me another copy of the book, and you need you to autograph it for me. And it's not for me, because the Chamber of Commerce in Norfolk, Virginia Beach, this whole area, they have mm-hmm. this annual meeting once a year, and it's like more than 1,000 people, and they have these big keynoters come in. Except every 4 years, whoever the new governor of Virginia is, they'll come and give a speech. So I sent this over to him, and I said, you've got to consider bringing Andrew Davis in for this big annual talk, because I'd seen others in the years before, and some were good and some were, okay.
Yeah.
So then he wants to set up a meeting with me. So I think, okay, great. So I go over there, and Andrew, I want you to know, we talk about suffering for our art. I then had to endure a 45-minute pitch on why I should join the Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, you're kidding.
Me and him. Oh. And I thought, okay, well, all right. This is really for Andrew. Bad. Andrew gave me an hour of his time. So
it's like you just paid it forward. Oh, man, I feel so terrible.
No, you shouldn't. You should. If they don't get it, that's fine. I mean, like I say, the client, Larry.
Yeah,
he saw Larry got it. He got it on fire, and this other guy had, you know, different interests. So,
oh my lord, Larry came up when I saw him in North Carolina, and immediate was like, "I'm friends with Douglas." Like, do you? Yeah, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, really? Yo, I think we even took a selfie together. If did I not send it to you?
I'm not sure.
I might have texted it to somebody else named Douglas in my phone.
Well, that's close enough. You're going to get partial credit for that.
I'm sure they were like, oh, this is weird.
Yeah, it's that guy who wore a tie to high school. Yeah.
That's right. I'll check. Because you know, I'm pretty sure I took a picture with him.
He's related to Vince Lombardi, the famous American football coach. Yeah. Wow. So shout out to all you folks in Wisconsin.
That's so cool.
So anyway, that was absolutely terrific, and it still comes up. And what I want to do, though, is, again, this all comes back to Andrew Davis, okay? So I saw you speak at Content Marketing World in 2018, mm-hmm. and you've been speaking there for many years, and you've been like the top keynoter at a few of them. Anyway, you gave this keynote, and just when I thought I couldn't be wowed by another one, you did I think it's your Curiosity Factor keynote.
Yeah.
And I could not believe it. And I just thought, what is the deal with this guy? I then saw you afterwards on getting on the escalator. And I said, and I really kind of half joking and not joking. And I said, Andrew, you just ruined it for every other speaker that's following you.
Oh, no.
But I couldn't believe it.
That's so kind. It was a real, that speech has become like a staple. I think it's my most requested speech for 2019 and 2020 actually so far.
I would go and see it again. I don't know if it exists on the internet or anything.
Yeah, it does. I'll send you a link.
We'll include a link to it at your episode's show notes at marketingbookcocktails.com.
Yes, sure. For sure. Yeah, yeah.
So that was great. And the other thing I remember, which this was not intended for me, but as you were giving the talk, and people who watch the video will see it, you had this, it was kind of like if anyone's ever seen the American comedian Jim Gaffigan, where he'll be talking, and then in a different voice, he starts saying what some of the people in the audience might be thinking, like, he's not very nice. Well, you weren't doing that, but you were saying, so I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, there's no way that would work. And then you would go, well, Doug.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know if that was directed at Doug Kessler or me, but I was like, damn.
It's every Doug, because every Doug asks, every Doug is like that. Doug Kessler, Doug Burnett, it doesn't matter who you are. The Douglases always are like, I don't know. I don't know, Andrew. Let me think about this.
Yeah. And it's the same ones that Marcus Sheridan jokes about this, where he has this great joke about how he'll be giving a workshop or a talk about how to do what he does so well. And there's always somebody sitting there with their arms crossed and they say, well, Marcus, that's all good and well. But you see, we're different.
Exactly. The we're different guy. Right. I don't think you understand. We're different. We can't post our prices up there on the webs. Because we're different. Yeah.
We're different.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, oh, he must be talking to the we're different guy, the Doug guy. Yeah.
That's him.
Well, I'm happy to wear that title.
Oh, my lord. That Doug character has evolved since then. His name is now Tony. You'll be glad to know.
Okay.
He's like a Brooklyn New Yorker. So I've been working on all these, you know, webinars that I've turned into like a television show. I've been shooting like 45-minute webinars, like a TV show with like, you know, sets and costumes. Somebody called it the Alton Brown of webinars.
I heard that. Now, does your wife Elizabeth help you with any of that?
She does. She's you know, I'm not good at asking for help, and she's offers constantly. And she's generally like for example, we shot we had a shot where I was walking behind the car and the whole camera setup was in the back of the car and she drove the car. Like that's the kind of involvement. Or, hey, hold the camera here. She's like, I don't know if it's recording, but I think it is. And then we go. She doesn't like to be on camera and she's like not really interested in that.
But if it involves puppets, she's all over it.
Yeah, if it's puppets, I don't have any puppets at home. But if I did, she'd be like, let's do this. I'm in.
Okay.
She, you know, her strong suit is organizing everything. So if I said, hey, let's, you know, I need to get from here to there, she can do it in a second and have everything on schedule, and it happens, which is the only reason these videos are finished, you know? So,
you crank them out like nobody's business. But you mentioned webinars. So what is happening with webinars, and what is happening with live events? I mean, you said you haven't been this at home this much in 8 years. What happens to a guy like Andrew Davis, who goes to all these live events? What do you think is going to happen in the short term?
Well, I think within 2 years, live events will be back the way they were before, I think. I don't think it'll drastically change. I do believe that, virtual events and webinars have a long way to go. And so as soon as this happened, as soon as we were stuck at home and, you know, events started postponing and canceling and turning into virtual events, I basically started asking myself one question, like, why do webinars look the way they look? Like, why is there a technical reason we can't do a television show? Is there a reason it can't feel like you're watching ESPN or, you know, watching Alton Brown on the Cooking Channel? Like, what's the limitation here? And within 2 days, I was like, well, there's no limitation. We can definitely do that. So, for the last 6 weeks, I've been trying to execute on that idea that we can do something unique and make an experience that people are really excited about being part of. So, I don't know if you went to the content marketing conference. That was one of the events I was supposed to keynote, but turned into a virtual event. And it's free, by the way, until the end of May. I don't know when this is coming out.
Oh, that was from Writers Access?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Writers Access is doing content marketing conference. It turned into a virtual event. It's free. And if you want to see what I think webinars are going to look like, I did a keynote there that you can just sign up and watch. It's 45 minutes and I hope it's lots of fun. But, I do think, and I really hope that this transforms what a virtual event can be, and that more people consider virtual events to be a real experience instead of just a webinar with a PowerPoint slide and a talking head, or sometimes no talking head, or just some graphics on video.
Oh, well, we'll make sure to include a link to however folks can access that. And if they need to sign up with their email, do it.
Yeah.
This brings to mind, when you were in Boston, did you ever meet a guy named Nick Morgan, an author?
Yeah, sure. I know Nick. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
he's great. I just interviewed him last week, and our conversation is going to air before his does, but I interviewed him about his book from 2 years ago called Can You Hear Me?
Can You Hear Me? Yeah.
Communications in a Virtual World. And in that book, as you probably know, he basically says there's a special place in communications hell for webinars.
Yeah.
And he was just saying, they're terrible. And the thing that brought to mind for me when I was reading about that was how I guess people think of them as slide decks, when there's actually so many other things they could be doing. And then it made me think of what I learned about the early days of television.
Yes.
Which is where they would have radio actors standing in front of a microphone. Yes. They just had cameras there showing the scripts.
That's so I did the same thing. So here's the thing. Like, that's exactly right. Like, whenever there's a technology revolution, especially one that's accelerated like a pandemic, right? All of a sudden, people are forced to kind of embrace the constraints and rethink what it should be. And there are a few visionaries, I think, that think through it. Like Ernie Kovacs. Do you remember Ernie Kovacs?
I remember the name. What did he do?
He was crazy, crazy smart television comedian. And he actually came out of radio. He used to be a radio stunt guy, which is kind of a funny thing to think about. Like he would broadcast a crazy stunt, like what it feels like to be run over by a train. And he'd, because it's radio, he doesn't have to get run over. Like that was the whole gag of the thing.
Oh, now you just spoiled it for us, Andrew.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, it was genius. Anyway, he did when he got to television, he started asking these really interesting questions like, hey, because now we only see what the camera sees, we can do really cool stuff. So have you ever seen one of those tilted room gags on video where the room is tilted and when you try to pour your milk, the milk won't go into the glass? Have you ever seen that?
It's kind of like the Fred Astaire movie.
That's exactly right. Fred Astaire basically stole the bit from Ernie Kovacs. Oh, he originally did it. And the whole gimmick is you know, I can tilt the set and I can tilt the camera. And as long as they're at the exact same angle, it looks like everything's normal until you start doing anything, then it looks crazy. And Ernie Kovacs was the kind of guy that, you know, really transformed television. And there are others. I was just talking to other people about this, you know, like the Kennedy Nixon debates, you know, all of a sudden intimacy and a clear understanding of what video means to be in your living room or in your office these days on a Zoom call is a much, like for a speaker like me, where usually I'm in front of 3,000 people in an auditorium, it's very different to be just you and me, Doug, like across the screen, even though there's 5,000 people attending the webinar, it's still a one-to-one medium, you know? Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time kind of thinking about what would make a webinar a better experience. Cause Nick is right. It is kind of, you know, the worst of the worst.
Yeah. He said it really, I had to laugh when I was reading it and I was thinking, yeah, these are pretty bad. And you know, they don't have very good attendance and
it's miserable.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I hope that, there's a lot of great developments that are going to come from all this. I mean, medically the way, governments and organizations respond, and there's all kinds of technology things that are going to come out of it.
Even businesses, like I've been shocked to see the kinds of businesses that I used to hear kind of avoiding technological change. Like, a lot of mom and pop businesses, I would kind of say fit into that category. No offense to mom and pops, but, there's a guy I met who runs an organizational consultant, you know, like I come into your house and I help your closets get organized.
Oh, okay.
And he had 300 consultants that were anywhere from part-time to full-time on his payroll. And as soon as this hit, he was about to shut down the whole business. Cause obviously now I can't go into your home and reorganize your stuff. Well, it turns out a marketing intern came into his office and said, "Hey, I have an idea. Let's just put up a form on our website and see if anybody would like to do a virtual appointment." Cause now everybody's home and all the stuff they haven't had time to do, they now have a time and access to do. Why don't we do that? Within a day, he had sold more in that first day for virtual appointments than he had sold in real appointments in the last 3 months.
Wow.
And he still has been able to keep on all 300 people. He's so busy. And so I think all of a sudden people are kind of embracing the constraints. Did you hear about GoToMeeting?
No.
GoToMeeting?
I know company.
The brand. Yeah. Yeah. The company. Okay. This is even funnier. So this, it's called Sweet Farms. It's a nonprofit organization that's dedicated to kind of helping educate and inform and help people understand where their food comes from and, you know, make a greener planet. It's like a great mission. And usually their revenue comes from corporate retreats. It's a really pretty place. And they invite corporations to do their corporate retreat there while you learn about, you know, farming and you do some work and build your team, you know? Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, when this happened, all those corporate retreats got canceled. So what did they do? They decided, this is so smart, they decided that they would liven up Zoom meetings and GoToMeetings and corporate, you know, virtual meetings by interrupting the meeting with a goat. So it's GoToMeeting. And you basically, for a donation of anywhere from $65 to $750, depending on what package you want, they will do this for you. And some of the expensive packages are like, not only do they interrupt the meeting, but the meeting turns into like, let's learn about, you know, the farm and talk about how it can help build our team, especially virtually, better. And they are raking in the donations, raking them in every single day. They're interrupting dozens and dozens of meetings.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
How genius.
You can smell the wood burning. I'm a slow learner. So it's not go to meeting or go to webinar. It's goat
to
meeting.
Yes. It's GOAT, the number 2, meeting.com.
Thank you for
and
your patience.
And by the way, I was trying to leave the punchline to the very end, but now
you did.
I'm 2 highlights in, and I think I forgot.
Well played, good sir. That, I love that. That's great. And they're just there from the farm.
They're from the farm live. And all of a sudden in the middle of your meeting, literally you got to look at the screenshots. Everybody out there, go look at the screenshots. It's hilarious. The goat just is sitting there chewing on his cud until somebody's like, "Hey guys, there's a goat in our meeting." And then they you know, break into the next piece of, it's just genius. And so, I mean, my point is that a lot of businesses that had never considered or thought virtual was realistic, all of a sudden these constraints allowed them the freedom to think creatively, execute fast, and all of a sudden experiment in ways that they never thought of before. And I think it's been pretty eye-opening and exciting for me.
Wow. Amazing. Well, no, regardless of where it comes out, the pressure's on, Andrew. We expect you to be kind of at the forefront. So not to add a lot of pressure, but we're kind of looking to you to lead us there.
Oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. It is really fun. I enjoy this kind of stuff, to be honest. It keeps me really excited.
Well, that's great. You're just going to keep on pressing on. You're kind of, you don't have any big travel plans. I mean, a lot of stuff got canceled.
I only had two cancellations so far. Most of them have been postponed or turned into virtual events. So I just did a virtual event in London last week. And I didn't have to travel, which was kind of nice. But to be honest, there are still events that are in August that are planning to go forward. And so, you know, as early as August, I could be on the road again speaking, if the current schedule allows. So we'll see. You know, I have lots and lots of gigs in September and October right now. And so if things get back to closer to normal, I would imagine those will still happen. And if not, I really do hope that you know, my virtual event experiment turns into something that actually could be, you know, even if the speaking business becomes like a full-time travel opportunity again, something that I can do and make a choice to not have to travel and do more and more virtual events at the kind of experience I want to deliver, because otherwise I'm not really interested in doing virtual events. Well, I don't want to be one of Nick Morgan's crappy webinars.
We're also self-conscious now that we've read Nick Morgan's book. But, you know, it's like so many other things that are layered on. And I was talking the other day to another author, a guy you probably run into a lot, Rohit Bhargava.
Oh, I love Rohit. Yeah.
And he was talking about how, like you, he's trying to see, well, where could this go? Okay, so maybe there's a live element to a talk you're going to give, but there are so many other things that we could actually have been layering on leading up to it and afterward.
Yep, for sure.
And I just thought that was, you know, so in other words, once you have, it's like Beethoven not having any hearing, it forced him to be more creative. And it's sort of like, if we can't be there, what's everything else we can do? And then I think a lot of people like you and Rohit and others are going to say, well, why weren't we always doing this? Or let's just keep doing it.
Yeah. And I think that's what's kind of fun about this. I just see, potential with every constraint that's been put on me. Like I was just, we have a swimming pool in our house, which is really nice.
But wasn't that required by law in Florida?
It really is. Right. But it's like it's a little Florida pool. It's not, I was a collegiate swimmer. Like if I get in the pool, I feel like I got to exercise and swim laps. And when
do you still have the Speedos?
Oh yeah, I still have the Speedos. In fact, I recently tried to put on my size 26-inch waist Speedo. My wife thought my legs were going to fall off.
And that's why she needed to take a break, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But the swimming pool is really small, so I can't really do laps. So, you know, I've lived here for 2 years. It's never occurred to me that I could just build like basically a swim tether, which is just a bungee cord and some parachute, you know, cord and like a little carabiner on the end and tie it to my belt and swim in my own infinity pool until this happened. Now all of a sudden I have an infinity pool. And so that's what I mean. Like, I think it has felt like we've been, you know, constricted and constrained and we've been stuck in this predicament. But with every one of the predicaments I found myself in with this kind of pandemic, I've found an opportunity on the other side that I didn't realize was there and ironically was there before the pandemic. It's just, it took this for me to figure it out. And I think that's kind of the beauty in it for me.
Yeah. It brings to mind the story. My son is an EMT in Virginia Beach in the Outer Banks. Wow. And, yeah, I will. He, as a matter of fact, we were concerned he's only 25 and he has been living here with us. And you know, you can make up all your jokes you want about having your kids living at home with you. Yeah. It's great having them here. Anyway, we were concerned about him, you know, catching the virus and then bringing it home and all that. And so there was a resort at the Virginia Beach oceanfront that said, well, we're empty and we're getting hammered.
Wow.
But if there are any coronavirus first responders that want a place to stay to kind of, you know,
oh man, that's fantastic.
Take a break, do that. So at any rate, he, dag nabbit, why was I telling you about him? We'll edit this part out.
You can leave that part in because we've been drinking. Right.
Now I remember. I'm sorry. And I apologize to the listener because I won't cut that out, because if Andrew Davis says do it that way, you do it that way.
You shoot it that way.
Okay. So he was telling me that in Virginia Beach, and probably in a lot of places, what they always had was a dispatch center where, you know, people would call 911 and the dispatch center would dispatch, you know, the fire department or the EMTs or the police or whatever. Well, then they had to, and quite often the firefighters will get to the scene of an accident before the ambulances will, because there's more of them and they're not fighting fires all the time.
Right.
And so anyway, then they said, well, now wait a minute, let's get smart about who we're sending to every one of these accidents. We don't need to have a rubber stamp cure, you know, one size fits all. So what they did was they said, all right, from now on, we're going to put a medical person there sitting next to the dispatch person. So the medical person's going to start asking questions. And it turns out that a number of the emergencies coming in, they were saying, well, actually, that's not an emergency. Mm. You need to call your physician about that.
Wow.
No kidding. Well, because a dispatch person isn't usually have medical training,
course,
and they have to follow the instructions. Or they would say, well, we don't need a whole fire team. We don't need a bunch of firefighters there. And they were concerned about the firefighters catching the virus.
Wow.
So they started getting, I mean, it was like one extra person, a few extra seconds, but they were getting smart about what they were doing.
That's so cool.
And my son said, you know, they should have always been doing that. And he said, and they're always going to do it from now on. I guarantee it. So,
wow, you're kidding. That's so cool.
So there's all kinds of thinking like that going on.
Yeah, I think there really is. You know, it's been fascinating to me to watch how people have reacted and how quickly they've come up with new ideas. Like, have you seen the guys at youshouldgetahaircut.com?
No.
So
I'm so glad we're having this call.
Yeah, right?
You should get a haircut. I should get one because my hair is getting rather long. And
yes. So these are a bunch of guys that their salon closed down, obviously, because of all of this. They very quickly decided, well, you know what? People are going to need a haircut. They don't know what they're doing, and neither does their spouse or partner. So why don't we do this? Why don't we book appointments where we'll get on a Zoom call, essentially, or a Skype call or a FaceTime call, and we'll walk the person through the haircut. And they're killing it. These guys are killing it.
Oh, wow.
And to the point at which they're thinking of not going back to running a full-time salon.
Oh, but everybody that hired them for that is going to come to them.
It's so true, except they're now not location-based. You know,
oh,
like,
wow.
It's just genius.
Yeah. So, you know, my wife is one of those horse people. She competes in horse events. And so she has one of those, you know, those trimmers.
Yes.
He's on a horse.
Yeah.
I'm so afraid she's going to suggest that she use it on me.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Although it probably looked pretty good because her horses look nice just before a horse show.
Yeah, you'd look fine. You'd look fine.
She'd probably braid my hair like she does the horses. So
yeah, you'd look great. That's really funny. How are the horses doing through all this?
They're fine, just like the dogs, because all of them are better fed and they all have better health care than I do. But that was the way it was before, Andrew. I mean, but it's, you know what? So that's not a problem as long as I know my place. So,
yes.
And
yes.
I'm sure there are lots of other horse husbands out there that, you know,
they can feel it.
Yeah. And, you know, and my heart aches for them too. But, you know, as long as we know where we stand. So, well, Andrew Davis, this has been way too much fun. Just like your keynotes and your books, you over deliver. And I appreciate the opportunity to have you here on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails. And I hope this has been a good break for Elizabeth.
It's been fantastic for me. She's going to be disappointed it's over. But I am too. So it goes both ways. Thanks a lot, man. This is fun.
I left my heart. San Francisco.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.